Well, if you're not finished, you're asking too many.
Kind of like you remember.
I'm not sure. I hope that I just made it up. I'm the first-hand source of that one.
You can believe me.
Hey, we can throw him a couple of minutes. There you go, when he comes in.
Well,
do some
I heard so much. We did. You like that one?
Yeah, but I heard it was rude.
I received a rumor and even a phone call or two that led me to believe that some of the students, if not all, were experiencing a certain amount of difficulty in, number one, interpreting the study outline, and number two, applying it to the actual assignment and reference tools and methods and coming up with the this paper. Amen. I heard a lot of amens out there. The rumor apparently has been confirmed and is actual fact, can be removed from the possibility column through the probability column right into the fact column. As a result of that, I have two things to say. A, notice how I have to speak logically since this is meant to be class. I have to speak in outline form. You can just, you know, follow. A, I want to apologize for not having taken you through the outline step by step last week before I gave the assignment, because I realize that now that there are some statements that are so ambiguous and or concise in this outline that there are 10 different ways to read them or interpret them or understand them. You have to analyze the study outline before you can use the study outline to analyze the Bible verse. So, so I want to apologize for not having done that. I really intended originally to get through the outline before, in explaining it, before I gave you the assignment so you really know what to do. But then my haste to make sure you had something to do last week, because I wanted to get maximum benefit out of this class in terms of having an assignment, a different assignment to work on every week for your benefit. I went ahead and gave it, and this felt just, well, since I'd explained part of it and I handed it out, that would be sufficient. I see now that that wasn't. Then B, what I wanted to say in regard to that was that I have decided that with your concurrence, I will postpone the due date of said assignment until next week. If enough of you feel like you just don't have it in shape, and as a result of the remarks we will make today, it will you know, it will benefit you enough to take the time to go over it and just add or amplify or revise what you've got and hand it back in. And so I want to take a vote then. How many would prefer that we postpone it until next week and that you have more time to work on it and maybe do a bit better job? Raise your hand if you'd like that. Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, that's a majority vote, so I guess we'll just go by majority rule here. Now, if you've got your assignment done, if you're in the other category, and you don't feel like you need to do anything else to it, just leave it and don't worry about it. And just hand it in next week. Okay, that's what we'll do then. And that will help, I think, some of you. Now, what I want to do today then, I'd like you to take out your study outline for verse analysis, file 1. I'd like to take out your assignment, whatever much of it you have done, or your research notes, or whatever you've got here. And what we're going to do is I'm going to take you point by point through this study outline and try to explain it to you as to what it is we're looking for here. Now, integrated in that explanation can be comments from the class in two veins. Vein number one, how it applied to this specific assignment, Hosea 11:4. Like, well, I found that trying to find the textual, criticism of Hosea 11:4, I didn't know what word to use or whatever. Or, vein number two, just general problems that you had that may or may not be even related specifically to this assignment, but that you have questions about or just comments on, maybe even helpful comments in general as to that area. The sources that we've listed are by no means an exhaustive list of every source that you could possibly use to advantage in every one of these steps and how you would use them. Only been some more basic ones. And if you found that in finding the authorship of the book, there's another reference book that we didn't list that is more helpful, that you can more quickly gain access to the information or works better or whatever, I'm open to adding that to the list, or we can add it here or whatever. And so that will, those comments can be interspersed with the presentation or explanation of the study outline. Okay? So that, now, last week I did talk about this whole first Roman numeral 1, didn't I? Observational analysis? Or did I? Or didn't I talk about this outline at all? I can't remember how far I got. Maybe I didn't get to it. Maybe I just handed it out. I know we talked about methods, different approaches. Is that that's about all we talked about then, huh? Okay, well, then let's take it from the top. First of all, let me tell you what the whole purpose of Roman numeral 1 is. It's to get your feet wet, to put it in a phrase. It's to get you give you a background for the authorship book, the introductory type material and questions, so that you've got some kind of a perspective to work from. And then secondly, to give you an overview of what some of the problem areas may turn out to be in your study. Now, what you've got to watch out for in that second regard is getting into too much detail too soon in this observational analysis area, because this whole thing is more of a checklist than anything else, just to help you see where some of the problems may lie. But you're not seeking to answer the problems or find the solutions to them in this first part. You're just seeking to identify them, if you can, through either a cursory reading of commentaries or through some of the sources, other sources that we've listed there, or by just looking at the text, if you can get it from that. All right? So the key word here is observation. Like we've got observational analysis, you're simply observing, you're simply looking at it. See, it's too easy when you try to interpret a verse of the Bible to just come up with a pat answer. The first thing that occurs to your mind, well, obviously when he said that he meant this, well, obviously this has to be fulfilled there, well, obviously this can't mean that. Well, obviously, to your obvious reasoning faculties, it may not. But sometimes there are not so obvious interpretations to Bible verses, or a little less superficial answers to the problems of exegesis. So this whole thing is to kind of slow you down, really is what it is, to put the brakes on. You know, the downhill tendency of, you know, you go as fast as you can to the answer, and boom, that's it. Now this is so slow, in fact, it slows you down so much that it can almost seem to be an encumbrance. And indeed it is, if you try to apply it legalistically and emphatically for every single verse. You know, you couldn't. I mean, after a while, you'd be studying the whole Bible for every verse that you study. You can't do that. You can't back up that far. You back up right out of the building. But it was purposely made more thorough than it had to be in order to show you every possibility and avenue of study and research. Because our minds tend to think on only certain levels all the time. One person, he just thinks about, you know, grammar, and so he's always checking for grammatical things. Another person, it's always manuscripts. Well, if I can just find out what the best reading is, then somehow the answer will come to me when I know what the actual text says. Another person is always thinking historically. Well, what was the historical situation? But he's not able to back away from that and think theologically as to how that applies to other places in the Bible that same doctrine is taught. He's just thinking historically. So it's to kind of get your mind, break it out of a rut type of thinking, and to make you look at all the different facets that come to bear on an understanding of verse or even a passage or a whole book of the Bible, because this can apply to, it doesn't have to just apply to one verse study, although it's been modified to apply to it. So with that, the first thing that you're doing in your survey, in your little cursory observation, is taking a historical overview, because we firmly believe in what I would call a modified approach to what the textbooks call the historical grammatical interpretation of the Bible. And by that we mean that you cannot fully understand the meaning of the Word of God outside of the historical and cultural context in which that revelation was given. It was given to a people in a certain time, in a certain clime, for a certain reason, that had a certain culture, that had a certain background, that saw things certain ways, that understood things. And you cannot wrench it from its historical context and force it into a 20th century motif and expect to interpret it. So, but I say we believe the grammatical is the same way. You cannot ignore the original languages that this revelation was vouchsafed in, and just go by a translation, an English translation or whatever, and expect to know every element of what was originally presented. You cannot ignore grammar, and assert that, well, he just said it any old way he wanted to say it. No, he was speaking to a people who were reading the Hebrew, who were reading the Greek, and he had to make it intelligible to them. He had to use the conveniences and the contrivances of human form of communication, with which involves figures of speech and grammar, proper grammar, and expression and everything else. Now I modify that in the sense that those who teach this classical historical grammatical method in your hermeneutical manuals and so forth take it to an extreme sometimes in the sense that they will hold so fast to that one single primary exegetical meaning that they will give you the interpretation of that verse, that they will not allow for some of the more subtle nuances that come only by revelation of the Holy Spirit in the Bible. For example, double meaning of words, or double meaning of application of prophecy, or a possibility of two or more, or applying on several levels or whatever. They have gone so far away from the allegorizing and spiritualizing method that they saw certain extremes in earlier church history, that many of them have come over now, and most of them are not spirit-filled to boot, and that hurts them, you know, enormously in this way, that they've taken it too far. So what I say is start with that, and get that meaning. Then go on and draw your applications, or look at your different levels, or tie it in systematically with the rest of the Bible, or whatever it is you're going to do, but you've got to start somewhere. And you can't start like your average Christian does. Your average Christian opens up his copy of the Living Bible, or the New International Version, or even a better translation like NASB or whatever, and he reads it, and he transports the Apostle Paul to 20th century L.A., and he thinks in terms of 20th century customs, 20th century thought, 20th century culture, 20th century philosophy, 20th century, you know, grammar, whatever, and he's not trying to, and he doesn't understand the flow of thought that the verse is sitting in Paul's argument, the argument he's trying to develop, the point he's trying to make, the whole background and setting, who was he writing to, why was he writing it, what was the problems. They don't think of any of that. They just say, well, how does this apply to me, or what is this, you know, relevant? If you've got to start with first base, and first base is what did it mean to them? What did it mean to the original reader? It meant something to them. When they cracked that book open, when it was originally penned to them, it had to have some meaning. Somehow it had to apply. How? And from there, you can draw your derivative applications or homiletical truths or spiritual applications or whatever you want to look at. So what we're doing first is backing up and saying, all right, wait a minute. What's the background of this verse? Maybe somehow that'll shed some light on understanding it. Now, these first three areas here, I think, are pretty basic, and probably you didn't have any questions on it, but if you did, shoot up the hand. First of all, you look at the author. And at the end, we list the sources that are involved in that. But in general, in most books, you just go to the front of the book if it's a New Testament epistle, you know, and you find who the author is right there. Paul, an apostle to the Gentiles. Or Book of Hosea, you know, Hosea the prophet, the son of Beeri, or whoever. So generally, you don't have to go any farther than that. If there is a question as to authorship, then maybe you'll have to crack a book on Old Testament introduction or New Testament introduction or whatever. Author, the date of the writing, the place of the writing, in other words, where was it written, to whom was it written, the occasion of the writing, meaning why did he write that? Did he write it, for example, in the case of 1 Corinthians, apparently some letters had been sent to Paul from Corinth asking him certain questions about certain areas, plus some rumors or some people from the house of Chloe or Chlo had come to him and had mentioned that there were divisions and schisms among the church in Corinth and problems. And so apparently, coupled with these written questions, there were these verbal problems that he had been made aware of, and that was the occasion for him writing that letter or epistle to the church at Corinth, to answer their questions, to clear up the divisions and schisms and to help them. So that's the occasion of writing. Yes.
On this one, in Hosea 11, well, in Hosea, is it all right if I give what I...
Yeah, go ahead. I like it.
I'm not sure if I was giving it the right occasion. I was thinking of, you know, the time. And so what I put down is, and see if this is going along with what they're after, or what you're after, or what the Talmud is after. During the time leading up to and including the Assyrian captivity of the 10 northern tribes. So I put down for a case. You're after more than that, right?
Right. We're after, in a sense, the purpose of the writing, although it's not totally synonymous with purpose. There might be the occasion of his writing may have been questions that he received, getting back to Paul's case, but the purpose that he had in writing it might have been to clear up those questions. So there can be a difference between the occasion and the purpose, but generally we think of the occasion as being the need that arose that called for the writing of that. At least that's generally how I take it. Yes.
So like what prompted him to
What prompted the writing? Right. Right. Now, in some cases, that will not always be clear. You know, what prompted Hosea to write that? You can be safe in the case of all the prophets, you know, and say, you could almost always say two things. Sin in the nation, which prompted a response from God because of his love for them, and therefore God came upon them. The classic text for that is probably the first chapter of Ezekiel, where it said that after his fifth year in captivity, the heavens were opened and he saw visions of God. So he was just, you know, there. He was just a priest who was in captivity by the river Kibar, and he was just there with them. All of a sudden, boom, God opens the heavens up and he begins to see these visions of cherubim and so forth. And so God is always the originator in any case of a biblical author, really. And as to, you know, but still, that doesn't mean there cannot be a natural occasion or something that prompted it. And so there's always both. There's always God as the source and the natural occasion. In Ezekiel's case, there was the captives in Babylonia, and they needed to know why they were in captivity and the sins that still remained in Judah, but what God's ultimate plans were for Israel and even for the Gentiles and the last day battle of Armageddon and so forth. So there's other things involved in here, but the point is you don't want to get too wordy in this. You're looking for brevity. So okay, that's what we're looking for the occasion. Now, in the case of Hosea, it may not be all that clear. I would say that the occasion for the writing of Hosea was obviously because of the sin of Israel, and that sin needed to be dealt with by God. But even more specifically than that, that Israel was on the brink of captivity, and so it was kind of a final plea, you know, a final plea from God for Israel to turn from their sins before they went into captivity. And so in a sense, you could say that was what the occasion of it was, because he's called the prophet of Israel's midnight hour. He came right, you know, right toward the end of their national existence. And so that could be an occasion. Okay? Six, the intent, plan, and scope of the author. Now, these are three different things. They're not synonymous words. Each word is there for a purpose. The intent of the author is exactly the same as the purpose. What was his purpose in writing that? And so you can say Hosea's purpose was to rebuke them sharply for their sins, to warn them of coming judgment, but throughout it all to show God's loving kindness for them if they would repent. That would be one way that you could phrase that. Not necessarily the only answer you could give, but this is just, you know, pretty much off the top of my head, knowing the book, what I would give. Now, that's his intent. That's his purpose. Now, what is his plan? That means, literally speaking, how does he go about it? So in Hosea's case, you might say his plan was to start off by enumerating. Now, this is not the case. This is hypothetical on my part. But to start off by enumerating the sins of Israel and by therefore of justifying the coming judgment of God. And then last, by promising them the messianic kingdom for those who would be faithful to God. Okay, so that's the plan. That's how he goes about. The plan is the method that the author devised to fulfill his purpose, to fulfill his intention. And the method is how he went about it. And so in a sense, it's almost like an outline, but you don't give an outline to the book. It somewhat corresponds to it, but it's what's in the outline. It's the meat of what the outline is, just the bare bones of. Okay, but again, if it can't be stated in a sentence or two, you're getting too wordy and you're getting lost in detail. And that's where you've got to really be careful in this first section, to remain brief, even if your brevity leads you to missing the mark. At this point, it's all right. You know why? Because when you get to later points in the outline and you get into some of these areas in more detail, you can always go back and modify what you thought was the general purpose. See? You can always modify later. That's the whole thing you need to remember. Otherwise, you'll sit there waiting for the, like we talked about the other time, that perfect sentence, that perfect revelation, that perfectly succinct, concise, accurate statement, and you'll end up wasting all your time on what usually will be a fairly insignificant part of your total research. So you got to watch that. That's his plan. Now, what is scope? Scope means how broad is he in the area that he covers, or to what depth does he cover it? Might be another way of saying it. For example, see if I can think of one. Yes. Right. What's the scope of the book? Is he detailing Israel's history all the way back to the Exodus and to try to show how they've been sinful, or is he just narrowing it down? So that would be the chronological scope. Chronologically, you could say the scope is just, you know, the period of Hosea's own ministry or lifetime. Theologically, the scope is just to deal with the sins, you know, of Israel and the judgment that God's going to bring, rather than the whole plan of God's salvation. That's historically, theologically. There might be some other angles that you could look at the scope, but the book itself would dictate what aspects of scope you're looking at.
Like, yeah. The amount of material we spend on
Right, like if Paul goes on for two chapters on faith, that's a fairly big scope. But if he just mentions the just shall live by faith and goes on, then the scope that he's covered that subject in is a narrow scope rather than a broad or intensive scope.
Like half the book, like the indictment, or
right.
The other half is kind of
right.
So quantitative.
Right. Right. How much he gets into this, what he gets into, how deep he gets into it. So intent, plan, and scope of the author you're looking at. Going back to point five for a minute, just to show you that these are not totally unnecessary, irrelevant points to a verse exegesis, I go back to that example of Paul in 1 Corinthians, and I think one of the keys, for example, to understanding 1 Corinthians chapter 14, where Paul is talking about tongues and prophecy and interpretation of tongues and within the scope of a church service, you cannot really understand that chapter and properly interpret it if you don't know the occasion of Paul's writing. That is, if you do not know that he was answering either questions that had been asked him concerning the use and abuse of tongues or trying to meet a situation that he had heard that was rampant in their church, with people standing up one after another speaking in tongues without interpretation. And he was trying to answer that rather than to give you a total, extensive, all-encompassing teaching on tongues, interpretation of tongues, and prophecy. And if you take 1 Corinthians 14 to be the latter, you'll misinterpret it, because it's not dealing with every aspect of tongues and interpretation of tongues and prophecy and the distinction between gift and sign all the time and this type of thing. That's not what he's involved in so much as he is answering specific questions or meeting specific problems that they had in their church services. And therefore, it's a lot narrower scope in that chapter than what a lot of people take it to be. So occasion of writing could be, even though it seems like a really preliminary, irrelevant point, can open up the whole chapter for you right there and lay it out and help you to more fully understand it. I've always likened 1 Corinthians 14 to listening to one half of a phone conversation. In fact, much of 1 Corinthians. Paul is talking, he's saying, now, concerning spiritual gifts, brethren, I would not have you ignorant. So obviously they were either asking him about spiritual gifts, or they thought they knew about spiritual gifts. Well, what about spiritual gifts, Paul? Well, concerning spiritual gifts, see, when we speak in tongues, we're speaking to each other. I mean, it's communication. No, he that speaketh in an unknown tongue speaketh not unto man, but speaketh unto God. Well, what about this? Well, about that, see, it's like you're listening to the other half. You're eavesdropping. Now, I've wished more than once that I could hear the other side of that conversation, to hear precisely what those questions were they asked him, or precisely what the nature of their problems were and their services, so I could more readily interpret his answers. But even from his answers, you can draw many inferences as to what the problems were that they had, or as to what the questions were that they posed to Paul, even from hearing from what he said. So he's dealing with specific areas, and that'll help you to interpret it. Okay. Seventh, the cultural geographic background. Cultural, we talked about the culture. What is the culture of the thing? For example, the cultural background of Corinth, and therefore the Corinthian Christians, may have some bearing upon the interpretation. In 1 Corinthians 14, because there was idolatry in the city, there were people probably with demons, possessed people, maybe even that spoke in tongues. You can think of the high priestess of their religion, or the prophetess, the oracle, and Delphi, and apparently she spoke in tongues, and the prophets who stood by her would interpret that, or would bring a prophecy from that, and there may have been certain ideas from their cultural background as formerly pagan, Greeks, that influence their concepts of some of these same types of things in Christianity. So the cultural milieu out of which these people or the author, if you're looking at the other end of the thing, came, can have some bearing on the interpretation of the verse or chapter or whatever. Geographic background as well. For example, going back to 1 Corinthians, the city of Corinth was a seaport, and it was a very, very urbane, very busy, bustling, melting pot type of city that had many different kinds of people in it, and was very, it was very much in contact with the rest of the world, and it was therefore very worldly, and that may have had some bearing upon some of the things that Paul had to say concerning some of the worldly practices that the Corinthian Christians were involved in. So the cultural geographic background, and again, you want to stay brief, because if later on a question arises in the course of trying to interpret the verse in one of these later categories, then you can get into that geographic thing more deeply if you need to. But at this point, you're just the bare minimum. You're just hitting the surface. All right, number eight, the context. General, specific, and immediate may have been confusing to you, but what we're looking at is the immediate context would be that which is surrounding the verse itself, if you're looking at a verse. The specific context would be maybe the chapter, for example. And the general context would most likely be the book itself, and perhaps even any other books, although not likely in this case, probably just the book itself written by the author. So general is roughly analogous to the book, the specific to the chapter, and the immediate to the verse. So it's just that radiating circles of context there that you're looking at. So what would you jot down there? What's the general context of the book of Hosea? And it, there's some overlap. It's almost like saying, what is the general intent of the book, or what is the plan of the book? The general context is, you know, admonitions to Israel to repent, or whatever you would put down there. The specific context of chapter, 11 of Hosea, would be more definitive than that. What did some of you put down, for example, for the specific context of Hosea? Yes.
God was drawing Israel with bands of love.
Okay, did you put that for specific or general?
I put that for specific.
Okay, what did you put for general?
Oh. God loves Israel and wants to correct them.
Okay, and so both of these kind of apply to the book as a whole, but one is getting more specific with what God is trying to say or do. Is that what you're doing? Mm-hmm. Okay. I would probably limit the specific a little bit more than that, as to proximity to the text that you're looking at. So I would say the whole book of Hosea, you could almost put those two things together that you put, and that whole thing could almost be the general context of Hosea, perhaps. And then for the specific context, you might put, for example, the whole chapter 11, which was comparing, this would just be off the top of my head again, comparing Israel's spirituality in their early history as contrasted with Israel's spirituality in later history. It might be just an example of what the immediate, the specific context is. For immediate, then you're looking at those actual verses surrounding that and whatever we're talking about there. Them going down to Egypt, and the judgment will remain on their cities, and maybe verse 7 then showing why the judgment will remain or abide on their cities. But then the verses following, God not really wanting to do it, but how else can he do it? Yes?
But I found it really useful in determining the general specific context, make an outline of the whole book or have one.
Yes.
And just, you know, narrow it down like I used
to. Right, otherwise you can be fooled by verse divisions, yeah, and chapter divisions, which aren't in the original.
Just ignore that. But I found out that chapters 9 and 11 were a good group that was right around,
yeah,
that.
Yeah, uh-huh.
You know, versus just before and just after.
That's a very good point. Outlining the book
real help.
Can help you to do that.
Sort of help you categorize.
I'm going to write that down on my...
Either an inductive outline or get it out of a survey book.
Right. And sometimes comparing two or more outlines that you found in different books can help you to get a view, because sometimes there's differences. But where you find agreement in general breakpoints, you know, among the several outlines, you can generally feel pretty safe that that's where they are, and you can even make up your own outline, eclectic outline, based upon looking at two or three others, plus a reading of the book two or three times yourself, and then come up with one.
Is that that way takes a lot.
Yeah, that's you know, spend more time there. Okay, now for sources for this historical overview, biblical sources refers to the Bible itself. Obviously, you're going to have to read through the Bible to find out some of this information, the context, and so forth. All of it you can find theoretically, just right straight from the text. But like we say, sometimes it helps to have an extra biblical work to kind of speed things up if you use them, you know, carefully. Biblical, the text, of course, first of all, if you can get into Greek or Hebrew, the versions refers to the earlier translations in the Hebrew and then the Greek, and then the translations, which most people who aren't familiar with the languages are going to be using, lay out a couple accurate translations and it will help. Maybe have a... I found that it can help to not just limit yourself to using the literal accurate translation, depending on what you're doing. Now, if you're trying to do translation work or something like that, then you may want to stick to that, although even there you may not. But depending on what you're trying to do, sometimes it helps to have even a paraphrase, even though you understand, well, that's really just a commentary. That's really his interpretation of the meaning. But once you understand that and take it in that light, it can be real helpful sometimes in arriving at the meaning or the connection of different sentences or the drift or the line of his author's thought or whatever. And it can be helpful to use translations that are laid out in a paragraph type form. That can help you for your context or help you for intent or the scope or the plan that the author has and how the book is laid out. Some translations almost lay their thing out in outline form. They put headings over different, you know, paragraphs, and you know they're not in the original. They put them in a different typeface, but they tell you what they feel is the topic of that paragraph or that group of verses. NAS does this, I think, and Rotherham also. So you're just reading. You're just reading in the text, and you've got to do that. You've got to read through it to acquaint yourself with what you're looking at there. Concordances there, we put one or two. This applies to the New Testament now, meaning if you can use the Greek, you use Moulton and Geddon concordance, which has the advantage of having the verses written out partially in Greek. I mean, part of the verse. They never write all the verse out. And the part that they've got written out right in Greek. And, see, am I looking at the right thing here? Right. And the New Englishmen, if you can't really use the Greek, then it's got the verses written out according to the King James, according to the English. Both of them, of course, are going to do the same thing in as much as they're going to give you every place that word is used if you're checking on other areas and other things. Three or four for the Hebrew, either Mandelkern's Concordance, which, by the way, the title is in Hebrew. If you've ever tried to use that one, it's black, and it's got red, and on the spine of it, it's in red, and then gold letters is the title, and it's in Hebrew. Then when you open the first page up, which is in the back, of course, what we would call the back, the face page on the right is in Hebrew, and the face page on the left is in Latin. And so it doesn't actually say Old Testament Concordance, Hebrew and Chaldee. It just says it in Hebrew on the right, and the left it's got in Latin, Veteris Testamenti Concordiance. So you've got to understand but it'll say Mandelkern, and that's your tip off there. So if you know nothing else, that's the only book we've got by him, I'm sure. So that one, again, the verses are listed and written out in the Hebrew. So if you can't use that and read it, then you'd want number four, Wigram's New Englishman's Hebrew Concordance, which is the same thing as the New Englishman's Greek does for the New Testament. Then, for the extra-biblical sources, commentators. Now, there's varying viewpoints as to where and when and to what extent you're going to use commentators in any Bible study, really, let alone this kind of a Bible study. Some feel that you should not use the commentators at all until you get right at the very end of the study. Like, if you notice, right at the end, we've got in 8, Number 8, Part B, commentaries. You could, if you wanted, not even touch a commentary until you got down to there, when you were already almost positive what your conclusion was and you had gone through all of this original research on your own. Then you could check the commentaries out and see how they jive with your opinion and translation, and also see if they bring up some new areas that you failed to take into consideration, in which case you're going to have to go back and do some more footwork, some more research. So some feel you should just save it till the end and not use it at all. Others feel if it can be of help to you, go ahead and use it as long as you don't let it color or influence your opinion, you know, too much as to what's being done. So if you can use it cautiously, I feel that it's, you know, it's proper in its place, especially if you're using it more for background information, which is what you're using it for in this anyway. You're using it to supplement, for background supplementary. For example, a lot of the times you're going to be using the introductory part of the commentary. So if you're dealing with Hosea, you might check Lane's commentary, his introduction on Hosea, or Ellicott's introduction to Hosea, or whatever, because that's where they get into background, scope, intent, plan of the author, a lot of the very things that you're looking at here in observational analysis, and so they can be helpful there. Old Testament and New Testament introductions, we've talked about, they can be helpful. Geographies, to find out the place of writing, number 3, and to find out geographic cultural background, number 7. Ditto with atlases and customs. Bible dictionaries can help you to get all of this information. Bible dictionaries aren't going to help you too much with number 8, your context. That's basically going to be your own. But all this other introductory material you can get from most of your good Bible dictionaries and encyclopedias. So those can be helpful there. Save you a lot of time. Yes?
I wasn't sure whether you wanted to do this or not, but I didn't do it, and that was our college notes are probably a wealth of information that we picked up, but I wasn't sure if you wanted to get familiar with the book.
You could use your college notes, but they are a good source of information, and they should always be kept in mind when you're doing study. They can help you a lot. But in this case, I did want the students to get familiar with the books and to learn how to use them. But for doing the assignment, for practical purposes, I think you could say you could use both. Now, if you were doing a formal paper and handing it in with all the proper bibliography, then you'd have to give credit for those sources too, and there's a way that you can do that for lecture notes, just like you can for a book or something. Yes?
One other comment on the commentary.
Mm-hmm.
For the historical overview, that's, you know, and you're just looking at the different parts. But once you get down into the medium jumping head, actually, you can say the comment script.
Does it apply to Part B? Okay.
Okay.
We'll get right into that. We're going to get into Part B now. Unless there's any other questions on Part A, on the historical overview. Did any of you run into any real problems in fulfilling Part A of this assignment? It's such a basic part, probably wouldn't be any trouble there.
Just where did you write it?
Place of writing,
yeah,
right.
Nobody knows.
Yeah, Israel is probably your best guess there, so that's where you were sent to. The Middle East, there you go. Eastern Hemisphere, huh?
Yeah.
Chris?
Yes? On dates there, sometimes, this one wasn't too bad, but sometimes there's I can't think of a book off the top of my head, but there's a wide discrepancy of dates. What do you feel? Should you give maybe 3 opinions and then go on?
That's exactly what I would do.
Okay.
That's exactly what I would do. If there's a discrepancy on dates or even in any of these areas, since we're in an introductory phase of our research, I would put down the various groups, you know, that are involved without even going into looking at too many books. But there's 2 or 3 opinions, put them, then put a question mark. Maybe circle the one that you feel, you know, is right if you have some background in the area at all and already a preconceived opinion or pre-arrived at opinion, and then go right on. And then later on, when you get into it, if it applies, if it's a real critical factor, like in some books it is, for example, the book of Obadiah, is there's an early date and a late date given for Obadiah. I take the early stand saying that it was the earliest of the minor prophets and during the reign of, what was it, Joash or Jehoram or something, Jehoram, I think, of Israel. Judah. And others take a late date, even after the Babylonian captivity, some of bring it way down. And it's going to, you know, the date that you give is going to reflect in your interpretation of the whole book, depending on, you know, what situation he's addressing himself to. So even in an area like that can be a critical factor sometimes. So you just put down the different ones and put a question mark and go on. And sometimes it'll be totally irrelevant to the final interpretation, you know, you write it in the verse and you can just leave it there, even if necessary. Okay, Part B then, textual and grammatical overview. So you can look at the text, and you can look at the grammar, but you're just overviewing both. Now, number one, literary genre, through a few people, I think, so I'll just go ahead and just briefly explain that. It's a 25-cent word, I'll grant that, but and we use it not to impress you with our vocabulary range, but just to acquaint you, with, for one reason, with terms that are you're going to be confronted with in different books. If you ever start reading books on methods and manuals and introductions, you'll see this term crop up. And it simply means the type of literature. That's all it means. What type of literature is it? So in other words, you're looking at it from a purely literary standpoint, okay, which is valid when you're studying the Bible. Once you don't stay there, you know, and remain only looking at it from that viewpoint, you're fine. Because God did lead the 35 or so Bible authors to write in different styles or different types of literature. For example, are you looking at historical narrative? That's one literary genre or type. Historical narrative. Some of what is in the book of Acts is historical narrative. A lot of what is in the Pentateuch and the historical books of the Old Testament is obviously historical narrative. Narrative is a story or a running account. So it's a running account of the history of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, their descendants, the history of the nation of Israel. And so if you're interpreting, you know, Joshua 21:5 or something, then you would just put down historical narrative and let it go at that, because that's what you're looking at. Is it epistolary as to the type of literature? Now again, it's a big sounding word, but it's speaking of an epistle, which is a letter. So is it a letter? Like if you're looking at Romans, and you're interpreting of Romans 5:12 or something, the type of literature, it's epistolary. In other words, Paul was writing a letter, and a letter is a certain type of literature that has its own format, in a sense, and its own limitations. Now, generally, your epistolary type of literature will also be discursive and logical. Discursive and logical. Now, what does that mean? Well, a discourse is an extended talk or writing on any one subject, you know. There's a difference between making a brief comment on something and then discoursing on it, extended discourse. So much of what Paul does in his epistles is discourse, you know, rather extended explanation of the various doctrines or teachings that he's talking about. It's discoursive and tends to be logical also. Now, that does not mean everything else is illogical and faulty reasoning, but by that we mean something that applies basically to your mentality. It appeals to the intellect in the sense that your reasoning, you know, now, you know, is this sin with God because God did this to Israel? God forbid, because Israel did this and therefore God had to do that. See, you're going through mental processes. You're going through a process of reasoning to arrive at a conclusion. And much of what Paul does in his epistles is of a discourses and logical nature. So that would be the literary genre. Dramatic. Is it apocalyptic, which means, of course, if it's prophecy, end time prophecy particularly, you would call it apocalyptic literature. Now, these terms have been used and abused in some books, so you've got to watch it. Doesn't mean that the term is invalid, that it's invalid to use that term. I mean, you're actually using a Bible term when you say apocalyptic, because apocalypsis refers to the revelation of God through the end time events as foreseen in prophecy. So apocalyptic means literature that deals with prophecy, particularly the end time events. Is it poetical? If you're trying to interpret some statement about God in one of the Psalms, then you're dealing with poetical, or if it's Song of Solomon and so forth, it's poetical in nature, Job. Is it parabolic? When Jesus said a certain man went forth to sow seed, you know, and you're trying to interpret this and find out, well, let's see, what is the seed, what's the sower? You're looking at a certain type of literature. You're looking at parabolic literature, or proverbial. You know, my son, follow the ways of, you know, thy father and mother, you know, something from the Proverbs, the proverbial, certain type of literature, which has its own particular brand. It has its own particular earmark. Proverbial literature is marked by a lot of contrast and parallelism and deduction, and it's very concise. It sums up in one little phrase what could take volumes of books to say, and there's various other characteristics that apply to that certain type of literature. And you cannot totally ignore the type of literature it is and therefore the mode that God is presenting this revelation in and expect to properly interpret it. So that's what we meant simply there. So with Hosea, all you'd have to say is prophecy or apocalyptic literature or prophetic unless we're not dealing with a prophecy here. If it's something that's more of a historical nature, you could say historical, or whatever you felt that that, you know, that category fit into. Boy, time is going so fast. 5 minutes and we're hardly even through this thing. Well, if we explain this first part, it'll explain a lot of what the later parts are, I think. Let me run through this quick. Okay, let me get this other one first. There were questions on divisions and subdivisions. What we mean is, determine the major divisions and subdivisions of the book. Of the book, okay? Now, that might seem misplaced under literary genre, and maybe it is. Maybe it should have been point number two under textual and grammatical overview. But what we're looking at is, this is kind of like where you can make an outline of the book. Because the writer will often present his material in discernible steps. And the development of these steps can be a historical development, you know, like you see the history develop of Israel. Step number one, the Exodus. Step number two, the law of Sinai. Step number three, the wanderings in the wilderness. Step number four, the crossing over Jordan and entrance into Canaan. Those are divisions in the book of Exodus and Numbers, let's say, or Joshua. It can take a chronological development, or a geographical, or a biographical development, a grammatical or a logical or any combination of these. It can take those methods of developing the material. There are several clues that you can look at to determine what the breakpoints are. A direct statement or a structural clue or a conjunction or a change of literary genre or a repetition of grammatical forms, abrupt change in person, voice, that type of thing. A change in subject matter, I think, is one of the most obvious breakpoints makes a division between one division and another, or one subdivision rather, when it changes the subject. For example, I think you've got a change between 1 Corinthians 11 and 12. In 12 he says, "Now concerning spiritual gifts, brethren, I would not have you to be ignorant." So he's been talking about something else in chapter 11 there. Now in chapter 12 he gets into a new subject, therefore it's a new division in the book. So you'd make that point B in your outline or whatever. Changes in thought pattern or logic, other things as well. Now, to get to the second point, you consult your interlinear in order to help you in your textual and grammatical overview, and this will be more or less help depending on how much, you know, linguistic background you have. But now, this Old Testament, pointed and unpointed, and then the punctuation, all we were saying there was that if you're looking at the Hebrew, determine whether there are any other ways that that word can be pointed, understanding that in the Masoretic text, or the original, the autograph, it was only a consonantal text. They only had consonants. And the Masoretes added the vowel points. And so the vowel points aren't inspired. What's inspired is the consonantal text, the consonant. And when the Hebrews read it, they supplied the vowels mentally themselves when they read it. Well, the Masoretes, feeling they understood what those words were because of the tradition carried down and so forth, supplied the point, so there'd be no mistaking which word was meant here, because you can have a word that can have four consonants in it, and maybe any one of three different sets of vowel points could fit into that, making it any one of three totally different words. And of course, context is going to be your safety in a lot of these cases as to which one you're going to fall upon, but a lot of times there are alternate pointings. And so this is what we mean pointed and unpointed. In other words, are there alternate pointings to this? Also, is there any alternate punctuation? Now, you're not going to tell just by looking at the interlinear, necessarily, if there are any alternate possibilities, unless you're really, you know, an astute grammarian. And so that's where you jump down to the sources. And the same sources listed above, plus a few others, that will bring up any problems that you might have. And so they might say, this word can be pointed this way, and it'll mean that. Pointed this way, and it'll mean that. You know, like Kyle might get into a talk about that in Kyle and Della's commentary. So that's all we're saying there, is check it out. Don't get into a big word study on it, but just see if there are any alternates, because this is an overview of something that you'll have to dig deeper into later if it is a problem or if it's there. New Testament, capital and lowercase, we're simply pointing out there to remember that in our unsealed manuscripts, like Aleph and B and so forth, they are all capital letters. They were all written in capital letters or unsealed letters. But when you use UBS Greek text or the Kingdom Interlinear, you're looking at lowercase letters. And therefore, you can miss what could be a textual problem or a scribal error, because with the unsealed script, there's an easy confusion of letters. A lot of the letters in the uncialed Greek alphabet look the same, and there are a lot of possibilities for scribal error that therefore resulted in manuscript variations or textual variations as a result of mistaking it. But if you're looking in a lowercase text, you don't even see how there could be any problem there. So you've got to be aware of that fact. A book might have made you aware of the fact, even though you were looking at the lowercase text, but if it didn't, then you wouldn't know it unless you maybe looked at the text yourself. Well, there's the last bell already. Are there any other specific questions in the last minute that I could hit, maybe, that we didn't cover? Rick?
Parsing words.
That just means tell what part of speech it is, noun, verb, so forth. Keywords, I think, is all you have to worry about here. The words, the key verbs, articles, if they're significant, prepositions. Of course, it depends on whether you're looking at Greek and Hebrew here. But the things that probably are going to look to be the most key in interpreting the verse would be the ones that you would parse grammatically. And your analytical lexicons, of course, are going to be the ones that are going to be the answer for you here. Larry?
In 5, grammatical analysis can be accidents and syntax.
Okay, accidents is the actual spelling of that word, how it is spelled in the verse that you're looking at. And so you're checking the spelling of it, and you're checking to see if there are any variations of the spelling of that word, okay, in those sources listed. Syntax refers to what we would normally call grammar, or how that word is set grammatically in conjunction with the other, in combination of the other words in the sentence. Syntax is how the words interact on each other in the sentence, in other words. In other words, if you're looking at a pronoun, you say, well, is the antecedent to that pronoun Paul? Or is it Apollos when it says he did not baptize anybody, save, you know, Gaius and Crispus? Is the he refer to Paul back in, you know, verse 10, or does it refer to Apollos? And so you're looking at syntax there, or a grammatical thing. So that's all that means. Another question. Randy, did you have one? Or was it Mark?
Oh, on parsing, it seems like that should be deferred until section 4, really.
Well, to get into it in much detail, I would, but maybe if there's a key word or two, and if you can just look it up real quick, it might help for an overview.
Yeah. I guess one more. On the first page, I'm just seeing interpretive problems. The difference between the word lexical and grammatical. The grammatical is how to use a sentence, and the lexical is how the words put together.
Lexical is just the word itself. And so here's where you're going to be using your word studies. In order to find the lexical meaning of a word, you're going to be using the lexicons and the word studies. And that word itself, what is its history? What is its background? What is its usage? But whereas grammatical is dealing with all the words in the sentence or verse and how they interact on each other, how they relate to each other, grammatical. Although there are some word studies that get into grammatical remarks, particularly in the New Testament, A.T. Robertson does get into some grammar and something to deal with more than just that one word in isolation and what it meant to the Greeks and so forth. So that's the difference between those two. Any other questions you might have had? Well, I hope I've given you enough additional information to help you on this. I'll just say my phone, you know my phone number, it's in the book, and if you've got a specific question that comes up that you can ask, write it down and then give me a call.